You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. Today's program is brought to you by Fairway Market. For more information, visit www.fairwaymarket.com.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and every Wednesday at 11 a.m. to 11:30, we talk about matters of taste. Visual taste, aesthetic taste, and of course, everyone's favorite topic on Heritage Radio Network, and my own personal favorite, culinary, gastronomic, gustatory taste. Every week we try to look at taste through a particular lens as it pertains to food. And this week we're talking about one of my favorite areas, and that's design, specifically restaurant design. And we're here today with James Bieber, an architect who has done many iconic restaurants, including actually some restaurants that defined an era, I think, of food in New York, Gotham Bar and Grill and Mesa Grill. Bolo Cafe, some great restaurants. So thank you for joining me, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Let's tell people at home that if you have any questions about restaurant design, taste, architecture, or I don't know, maybe you're cooking something and you need some advice, you can call us at 718-497-2128. We're here till 11:30. And again, we're talking about taste. So tell me, James Bieber, architect. What is it that architecture adds to a restaurant experience?
I remember the first restaurant I designed, which was the Gotham Bar and Grill, as you say, which is I'm startled and amazed that it is still around.
Amazing,
and we can still talk about. I remember one of the owners saying, "Look, and none of us had any idea how to design a restaurant at that point or run a restaurant." And one of the owners said, "Look, there are five things." Yeah, he said there were five things about a restaurant. He was a kind of a real estate-y kind of guy. There's like, there's the food, and there's the service, and there's the value. And there's the location, and then all the way down at the bottom of that was design. And he said, if you get three of them right, I think you have a pretty good chance of staying. If you get four right, that's a success. If you get all five right, bingo.
Wow.
So I'd say it's one element that can, I believe that in that case, design saved the restaurant long enough for Alfred Portale to really make it a success. Now I think the design is pretty much irrelevant. It's nice that it's there. It's 25 years old.
I was going to say, but 25 years ago, that was probably a different ratio, I would think, because you can't open a restaurant these days in New York and not have something eye-catching or some vibe in a restaurant that perhaps from that moment in the 80s when Gotham began came to stand for a restaurant in New York.
I think it was one of those spectator restaurants where everyone became part of the scene and the architecture was the kind of stage set. It did create a different kind of self-consciousness about design from that moment on. I think it is still true now that design is, we're sitting in a restaurant now that I would say is not designed, but is utterly charming and successful, Roberta's. And it is not a feature here and will never get in the way.
So let's talk about that a little bit since we're looking at it through the window of the studio. It is not designed, and yet things did not just grow here. They were selected to put here. And what do you mean by that?
I think they did just grow here. I think that the restaurant clearly wasn't created at one time, and it wasn't created with a single idea in mind, and it wasn't created for to enhance the food idea as much as it was to provide a kind of lifestyle for the people that are here in the neighborhood and so on. And I think that is design, where maybe with a small D instead of a large D, but it isn't self-conscious design, and it isn't the brand. I don't know that what most people think of when they think of Roberta's. I'm not sure they think of the space. They probably think of the people, the food, the experience.
Right. maybe the radio station. Maybe, probably let's not. Hope. Most people don't even know we're sitting back there.
Exactly.
So fast forward 25 years since Gotham, you're still working on restaurant projects. In fact, we met over a James Beard Foundation project, the pop-up at Chelsea Market called JBF Limited, that you didn't only design, but in many ways you contributed to the concept. And in fact, when you say this restaurant wasn't designed from the beginning, that's what I hear, is it wasn't a concept before it was a restaurant. It sort of went the other way, the old-fashioned way. Talk a little bit about today making a restaurant concept a success in New York.
Well, you know, I love the James Beard Foundation because it's such a, because it was so fast and such a limited run that, and so successful in its limited run,
right.
that it's easy to talk about how it's a kind of small scale paragon of what restaurant design is. You know, we really good design takes into account the food, the service, the style of ownership, the style of service. And at James Beard Foundation, it was 8 or 10 different chef
Chefs,
combinations,
yeah.
and
yeah.
lots of others in between, and lots of other events happening yeah. at the same time. But so it had to, it couldn't be a single brand for a single chef. On the other hand, it had to be an umbrella for all those, but it had to do something else. And what we happened on in discussions, but also just in, yeah, just to back up, you know, architects love to solve problems. And mm-hmm. I remember when you came to me and told me the problem, you said, could you do this and this and this in, you know, 2 weeks and for this amount of money? And I said, no, you cannot do all those things. But because architects are kind of, and other designers are kind of addicts to solving problems,
right.
that challenge, and you probably knew this, but, you know, it's only sort of semi-conscious in architects, that challenge had me thinking about it. And by the next time we talked, which might have been a day or two later,
yeah.
I said, yeah, actually, I do have this one idea. And I'm often quoted as saying, I just have one idea.
And that's only takes one. Good
it
one.
Only takes, exactly. It only takes one idea. And the idea in that case was that the limited run of the restaurant, 27 days, with only some of them being food, sort of chef food evenings, was such a strong character. That is, in New York, you know, if you don't get it in those 27 days, you miss it. And
mm-hmm.
that impetus, that kind of perishable date, was such a strong idea that we turned that into the concept of the restaurant, and then turned that concept into a visual concept, which had, you know, in the end, had chefs doing graffiti on the tables, which were numbered 1 to 27. And that became the kind of both the theater of the restaurant, the end of evening theater, but also the brand, the ad brand, the facade. It became everything. We were lucky.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely worked. And one of the things that I thought was so great about it, not just for us, but we made good on this idea that you've heard about since Joe Baum invented the American restaurant at the Four Seasons, you know, 55 years ago. And that is that restaurants are theater, that they are temporal, that what happens in a restaurant, yes, you build a restaurant to last a long time, although they last shorter than some other businesses. But what you're really trying to do is to capture that meal, that dinner, that lunch, that something that happens in that room that the next night is totally different in a totally different place. And so
exactly.
This idea, I think you were quoted as saying it was an architecture of urgency, to me, led a real concrete idea. Well, except that it's conceptual, but really nailed the concept of a pop-up, which we were in that moment and still are a little bit in the era of the pop-up, the quick restaurant, the quick
mm-hmm.
fix.
Well, some unintentionally, but you know, I think that it was a kind of inside joke about New Yorkers' anxiety about missing something. You know, every New Yorker doesn't want to miss the thing, and by putting a countdown clock on it, I think it was just a little bit of an inside joke about that. But every New Yorker got that joke.
So where are there restaurants that are designed right now? Now, in fact, we live in this moment where not only is architecture risen up in that list of criteria for what mm-hmm. makes a successful restaurant, but there are architecture firms. I'm thinking of Avroco that
sure.
actually are restaurateurs now.
Sure.
Is there some, are there restaurants now that you think are great in New York or elsewhere that you
think? I think
there
are tons of really great yeah. restaurants, but I think that the notion that design, this is a kind of a global design issue, which is that the brand of the designer very often, or the design brand has become an important selling point for high-end apartments,
mm-hmm.
new museums, corporate headquarters. And so design takes on a completely different role, and architecture takes on a different role than it did 25 or 30 years ago in a much more marketing savvy sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, restaurants are more explicitly marketed and more explicitly branded. That may or may not be good for restaurants or even important, But I think there are, you know, I think there are a million really great restaurants in New York and everywhere. And I, you know, they range from things like, and these are personal favorites because of, in part because of food, but even, but Balthazar, for example, is a perfect reproduction of something that never existed, except in the minds of people that, you know, that have collected all these images and experiences from France. And it is a kind of perfect experience in that sense. I remember when I used to, I had an office around the corner in the 80s, and that's where I used to buy leather. That was a kind of, you know, a kind of an Orthodox Jewish leather store. And it had none of the interior that it has now, and it was entirely created. So the artifice, the kind of Disney aspect of it, is spectacular.
Right. I actually once wrote an academic paper about it, because we shun in the food world, the idea of a theme restaurant is just so egregious from the standpoint of authenticity and what we expect in food. And yet I thought Balthazar is the greatest theme restaurant ever built. It,
I guess, except when it's really well done.
Right, exactly.
Because, it is, you know, and theme restaurant is another interesting question. You know, at MoMA, there are two or three restaurants, two really good ones, I think. You know, the Modern is a fantastic restaurant in virtually every way. And the cafe upstairs is maybe the best cafe on the second floor. Second or third floor is the best cafe of its kind. And both are branded MoMA in very subtle ways, with a huge Thomas DeMond print or with a kind of a designy sense upstairs and being really closely connected to shows. But they're fantastic restaurants, and not in the least because of the quality of the food and so on. If you're on really modern restaurants, on the list of really modern restaurants, Perry Street is perhaps the most sort of, you know, considering that it sits by a highway, the most serene, beautiful, relaxed, and kind of elegant space, I think, in New York. It's just an absolutely beautiful space.
I find that room also transporting, in that I feel like I'm not in New York. It feels like I'm in Sydney and I should be looking at the Opera House from where I'm sitting or something. It just is a...
And what's amazing is that here it has this view that it both denies and reveals through a kind of transparent band in the curtains. And so it's in a place, a very specific place, and yet attempts to back away from that place and be every place. You know, it'd be at the top of a building or Sydney. You know, I still love the Grill Room at Four Seasons. I think it is a really remarkable architectural construction that somehow works as a fantastic restaurant. I think I like it more than the Pool Room.
Right.
And
say a little bit more about that. Room.
It's
to me that when I that to me is the that to me defined what an American restaurant was, because it feels like a bank. It's in the base of a building. It is about it oozes power in a way that no restaurant I've ever been to in Europe or anywhere has, and is still sort of a beautiful environment to be in more than 50 years later.
And that's it's genius. It does exude power and is still a kind of amazingly comfortable place to be. And so all the other restaurants that exude power, things like 21 or name some others that are actually powerful places.
Well, Danielle is a powerful place.
Sure. You know, those places, I think, do it without the... Well, they're much later constructions, not 21, but they're much later constructions, but they don't embrace modernism. That may actually be the trick in that period. It's funny because we're just going through this Manufacturers Hanover Trust interior destruction issue, and so right nearby is another kind of grand example of 1950s transparency and power. You know, a bank, a totally transparent bank on Fifth Avenue, and there is something about power, about being able, accessible power, that's really attractive to us all.
Especially in New York, us in New York. What makes, I know this is an impossible question, but what makes something enduring in design? And I ask that because I remember a conversation years ago with the owners of the Four Seasons, and I was saying how it's incredible that it just, I mean, you walk in and it still feels modern. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and that was so long ago. I mean, there was, think of what was around 60 years ago. And yet, Alex von Bitter then said, well, in the 70s, you should have been here when everyone just thought we looked old, you know? So at a certain point, is it just time, or
you know, everyone who makes something that they expect to last for a long time always uses the word, well, this has to be classic. We want this to be a classic design. Well, of course, a classic design is simply the design that manages to last, and it's not. It is, I think I remember when we designed the Gotham Bar and Grill. I was there at the opening night with a reporter. She was then the reporter of the New York Times, Suzanne Slazen, and I said, "So, you know, does this have any chance?" And she said, "Listen, Jim, this is really very nice, but it'll be over in just a few minutes, you know."
Really?
And the funny thing is that it's not over. It persists. It has a kind of third generation, fourth life charm. In my view, it's time to redo it, but that's because I'm ready for, I think,
right.
I'm ready
something
to do something, mm-hmm. to do something updated, but still within the confines of what it is. So if it became classic, it was entirely inadvertent. It was very much of the moment and very temporal at the time.
Right.
You know, so it lasted. I don't think it lasted because of the design. I think it lasted because of Alfred.
Right.
Alfred's food is remarkable. His consistency is remarkable. And he's managed to do it for all this time.
And interestingly enough, he became known for something that was called architectural cuisine.
Exactly.
And yet it became a trend, but he's the only one who seemed to manage to make it real somehow.
Exactly.
And still does.
You know, yeah. Some of those same dishes are still on the menu.
Yeah, and they're still delicious.
And they're still delicious. Yeah. And you still go there and eat them. It was 1983 or 84, I think, that we opened. So it's absolutely an amazing time. So if you look at things like, one great example is the Marcel Breuer chair, the Cesca chair, that's been knocked off. So it was knocked off so many times by so many people that it just became a joke. A very fine piece of design, an absolutely
right.
terrific piece of design. And so through no fault of the designer and the quality of the piece, culture seems to mistreat some and celebrate others.
Well, on that note, we'll take a small break. You're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis, and we'll be right back. Miss Antoinette, she went out with a song. Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. I'm talking with architect James Bieber, who, in addition to having designed earlier this year the James Beard Foundation pop-up, JBF Limited, has also had his hand in some of the iconic restaurants of New York City, Gotham Bar and Grill, Mesa Grill. Sorry, I was just thinking Mesa Bar and Grill doesn't sound right. Bolo, and some others, including some other great projects. You can call us with questions if you have them about restaurants, design, taste, anything really, because we both like to talk at 718-497-2128. So let's get deeper into the relationship between architecture and design and food itself. I mean, always, there's the old saw, you eat with your eyes before you eat with your mouth, mm-hmm. and there's definitely a visual component to food. But even structurally and perhaps metaphorically, I think we think of a relationship between construction and building and design and the food that we eat, especially in restaurants, maybe less so at home. Any thoughts about?
I would say at a certain level, I do believe that design is design and that cooking is a kind of form of design and of making things, let's say. Mm-hmm. And so I would imagine that the chef goes through a lot of the same processes that a designer goes through when they are presented with a group of ingredients or a particular dinner of a particular theme for a particular bunch of people, that they're attempting to solve a problem of how to make something iconic or metaphorically represent this group. And so it's a bit like, if the restaurant and food are the book, the design is the cover. And so it can't explain the food or the restaurant or the experience, but it can provide a kind of iconic or image related identity for all that. And I think that whole act is an act of abstraction and artistic creation and so on, but also problem solving, as I said before.
Right. And there is an element, I guess, also that in the end, there's a client, and you also, right. you can't, you're not just making abstract art, for instance, for the art's sake, but you actually are also crafting something for.
And I think that you have to, you know, if you're good at it and if your own brand isn't the most important thing in the world, then I think you're obliged to extract that information from the client, the food, the place, the context, whatever. You know, I remember when we did Mesa Grill, which was the first restaurant that Bobby Flay owned, was the owner, and he was cooking at a place called Miracle Grill at the time. And when we went to eat the food was fantastic, and it was a kitchen the size of this studio, which is extremely small, and a tiny little restaurant. The food was just so colorful and so beautifully composed, and it tasted like those colors. That's where the kind of what now seem like fairly tame colors in a restaurant came. You know, all the plates on the table are different colors. All the colors of the restaurant are kind of, bright and bold. And that was a way, along with some other American references, to encapsulate the idea of his food. And then, you know, we layered things like the cowboy print fabric, which was a little bit of a joke about the Southwest, and then these big black and white photographs, which were really snapshots, really postcards of America. Because in the end, this is a New York restaurant, not a Southwest restaurant. It was a New York restaurateurs and chef's idea about the Southwest. And right. So we never wanted it to remove it from, we never wanted to style it in a Southwest manner.
Because that would make it a theme restaurant.
And also, I think, dishonestly represent the food.
Right.
The food really was Bobby's. And right. Bob, for all I know, you know, I think when Bobby did Bolo, I'm not sure he'd actually ever been to Spain.
I recall that.
And
yes.
That didn't matter because he was so good at making this his own. And so the same thing was true of Bolo, that we, in fact, when it got too close to Spain, there was one collage image we kept trying to put on the wall. And he at one point he said, "Now you're mocking me," and we had to cover over this image because it really was too literal for him, rightly so.
Mm-hmm. Are there trends happening right now in architecture in general, or specifically in restaurant design? Right now in food, there's a huge rise in the new Nordic cuisine moment. Mm. We had last week on Adam Oman, who's opening a Danish restaurant, and obviously Danish design and Danish food had a moment, perhaps in New York. I grew up in the midst of it, surrounded by all of the objects of it, and it seems to be coming back again in the form of smørrebrød sandwiches, but also in the chair in his new restaurant. Is there anything happening in that way coming back?
You know, I think there are a lot of things happening, and I think that this, you know, the room we're sitting in is a little bit emblematic of some of them, which is that about 40% of all restaurants in New York now seem to have some sort of recycled wood paneling, and it's a trend I'm not dying to participate in, but you do see it everywhere, and it becomes a kind of visual trope of the time, I think.
Right. Back to food and architecture and the metaphor of one and the other, I guess. Through you, I received a beautiful little book called Paris Pastry. Talk to me about that project.
Susan Hochbaum, who is a graphic designer and was once a colleague of mine at Pentagram Design, created, while she spent a year in Paris, more or less by accident, started photographing the pastry she would buy every day. And she would buy a different piece of pastry every day. Then she started photographing it sort of in context of wherever she bought it or in appropriate context and started making analogies between the pastry and Paris architecture. And so Paris Pastry is really a kind of fun dual page, you know, book of spreads of pastry on one side and architecture on the other. And sometimes the architecture is a really beautiful pleated dress, and sometimes the architecture is a dome,
right?
Or a sort of little joke about Napoleon's hat. But it's not that it's easy, but it seemed inevitable once she did it because of the obvious relationships between construction of one kind and construction of another.
It's very evocative, I have to say. You flip through and you have these little giggly aha moments when you see a Mont Blanc or a Saint Honoré juxtaposed against some iconic Parisian building, and they do look alike. The great French chef Antonin Carême from the 18th century, when as the French do, he codified things and he drew sort of hierarchies of relationships of cultural arts, sort of an encyclopedist of a neo-encyclopedist, and he put pastry under architecture, not under food. And so I think perhaps that came to, after his life, perhaps that came to be true. What if you could think about food, say you were going to do that project about New York now, do you think there, you know, where's the hamburger building or the cupcake or the piece of pie?
Yeah, it would almost be easier to do about Los Angeles, where literally there is a hamburger building,
right,
and literally there is a hot dog building. It's a kind of it's difficult to find it requires a level of abstraction that I'm not sure exists here. I think Paris, there are Olympic competitions about pastry. Mm-hmm. You know, there are very serious, you know, medals and you know the name of the organization. You become
the Bocuse d'Or, the Maître Ouvrier de France, MOF.
And so becoming a pastry chef a qualified pastry chef in Paris is akin to getting an architectural license,
right,
in a way. It's at least as difficult and maybe much more exclusive. So it seems it's a kind of cultural it's a cultural thing.
Do you cook?
I do. I always cooked because I was a latchkey kid, and so always cooked meals for myself and my brother, but didn't for a very long, I was able to cook for a long time, but never thought much about it until, you know, around the financial crisis, work began to slow down, and what I realized was that I wasn't making things in the office fast enough. I wasn't busy enough making architecture, and then without even thinking about it, I started to cook, and I started to cook kind of every weekend and started making meals, and I wasn't even eating these meals, and I wasn't even
clear.
I wasn't even clear who they were for. We had to sort of invite people over, and then when my office was in my home for a while, I found out who the audience was. But now I'm kind of way too busy to cook much, and it's an occasional thing.
Do you think you cook like an architect?
You know, we had a fantastic, one of my clients, Steven Esprinio, is doing a project for a new new restaurant, and came to my home to cook the food for a group of 20 people. And watching him cook in the space that I cook in made me realize, I'm not sure I cook like an architect. I cook like an amateur, that's for sure. But to watch someone who's truly tuned to cooking is like watching someone blow glass or make metalwork or paint or do anything that they are really skilled at. I'm in awe of it. I'm an absolute amateur.
Well, you made a nice lunch for me, or assembled a nice lunch for me recently.
Out of fear, yeah. I wasn't driven by fear.
Do you think, you know, like seasonings, like hot peppers or something, do you think there can be too much design in some place? Is there such a thing? If it's good, is it?
You know, there can be way too much design for my taste. And I think that there is a tendency sometimes to over embellish. There can be too much design in food, and mm-hmm. I've eaten in certain restaurants where the design is just kind of gets in the way of the food, or the seasoning gets in the way of the food. I think the same thing is true of design. It's funny that I probably think you could never have too little design. If the food is great, you're happy to eat it on a table by the sand. If it's not, no amount of elaboration really makes a difference.
Interesting. We are. Do you have a favorite food? Just curious.
I don't.
You don't.
I don't.
Okay. Well, that's the end of that question. Line of questioning. No, that's quite all right.
And I don't have a favorite restaurant. A favorite piece of architecture in New York. And people ask me, like, "What's your favorite building in New York?" I never figured out the answer to that question.
Because you're too much in the moment or in the environment.
Actually, for me, and maybe this is the same thing of food. The buildings in New York aren't really the point. The streets in New York are the spaces the buildings make are the point. And so iconic buildings, you know, the best group of iconic buildings that was ever in New York was the World's Fair, the 39 and the 64
right.
World's Fair. But that's not a city, and I really love cities. And maybe for the same reason, as someone said to me about music, I like all really good music. And I think I like all really good food.
Right.
And quite a bit of bad food as well. But but so it's time specific or mood specific.
Right. What mood are you in today? Are you in the mood for a pizza?
Yeah, you know, I really am now.
Good.
It's kind of early for pizza, but.
Well, we've been talking with architect James Bieber of Bieber Architects, who has a lot of interesting things to say about design and food and a whole bunch of other stuff. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks really for having me. It's been a delight.
Next week, we are going to welcome Karen Karp, my colleague and partner in the James Beard Foundation Sustainability projects and the annual food conference that we just completed. And she is going to be talking about some of her projects in New York City regarding food and food access and procurement and providing distribution for some of the incredible food that we grow in our hinterland here in New York City, and some of the challenges about how it gets here. You're listening to Taste Matters. I'm Mitchell Davis. I'm the Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. You can find these shows on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network. We are here weekly, Wednesdays at 11 a.m. to 11:30. Eat something delicious between now and next Wednesday.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from Food Karma. To kick off the New York City Meat Week in style, Meat with a Twist will bring together the best chefs and mixologists for a cocktail food pairing party on November 7th from 6 to 10 p.m. at City Winery. Meat with a Twist features 10 cocktails paired with 10 chef selections highlighting local, sustainably grown meats such as duck, lamb, chicken, pork, beef, bison, and ostrich. The party will launch a week's worth of events throughout the city that celebrate the slow food movement bringing sustainable meats to our tables. Again, that's November 7th from 6 to 10 p.m. at City Winery. Updates, tickets, and more information are available at meatweeknyc.com.